on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. European Union governments have agreed to ration natural gas this winter. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
On Monday, Russian energy giant Gazprom said it would limit supplies to the EU through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to 20% of capacity, heightening concerns that Russian President Vladimir Putin will use gas trade to challenge the bloc's opposition to the war in Ukraine. German Minister Robert Habeck says he supports the deal to ration gas in the EU.
I think it's an important, very important next step. It shows that Europe stays united, that Europe is able to find unity and giving a strong signal also in the day where the flows of gas in Nord Stream 1 are reduced to another 20%.
Although the bloc has agreed to embargo oil and coal from Russia starting later this year, it's refrained from imposing sanctions on Russian natural gas because some states rely heavily on these imports. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The Kremlin said Tuesday that a gas turbine for Nord Stream 1, Russia's biggest gas pipeline in Europe, had not yet arrived after maintenance in Canada, and that a second turbine was showing defects. The Kremlin says shortfalls in supply have been caused by maintenance issues and the impact of Western sanctions. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said the sanctions against Russia had critically complicated the work of Nord Stream 1, which is reducing gas supplies to Europe to just 20% of its capacity amid maintenance. Britain said Tuesday it had sanctioned Kremlin-imposed officials in the Luhansk and Donetsk provinces in eastern Ukraine, as well as 29 regional governors across Russia in response to Moscow's invasion of the former Soviet Republic. From Washington, this is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden has completed his course of antiviral pills for COVID-19 and is feeling what the White House calls well enough to resume physical exercise as his symptoms dissipate. This according to his White House doctor Tuesday. Mr. Biden, who has isolated at the White House since testing positive for the coronavirus last Thursday, is a keen cyclist and has been reported to start his days with a workout that includes lifting weights. Indiana lawmakers have begun considering a Republican proposal to ban nearly all abortions in the state. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
Thousands of people on both sides of the issue surrounded the Indiana State House Monday as Vice President Kamala Harris met with Democratic state legislators, saying abortion is a personal decision.
The government should not be telling an individual what to do, especially as it relates to one of the most intimate and personal decisions a woman could make.
The legislation would ban abortions except for in the case of rape, incest, or the life of the mother. But bill sponsor and Republican State Senator Sue Glick says she expects amendments to be considered that would tighten those exceptions. I'm Donna Warder.
Morocco and Israel added legal links to a growing list of cooperation accords since they normalized relations in 2020 during a visit Tuesday by Israeli Justice Minister Gideon Saar. He signed a judicial accord in Rabat with his Moroccan counterpart. A joint statement said the two countries would share expertise and modernize their judicial systems through digitalization while cooperating in the fight against organized crime, terrorism, and human trafficking. Australia's parliament sits for the first time since the May elections, with the country's new prime minister determined to have a greenhouse gas reduction target enshrined in law. Legislation that would force Australia to reduce its emissions by 43% below 2005 levels by the end of the decade will be introduced into the House of Representatives this week. If the prime minister, Anthony Albanese, says Labor can persuade all 12 senators from the minor Greens party to support the bill, it will only need one more senator from the remaining six available to achieve a majority. The Greens want Australia to slash its emissions by 75% by 2030. And firefighters made progress battling California's largest wildfire of the summer Tuesday, with more than one quarter of the blaze near Yosemite National Park contained. By Tuesday, nearly 3,000 firefighters and 24 helicopters at the scene had achieved some success containing the blaze, aided by slightly higher humidity levels. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Probably this is not the end of the transition, but this is a big setback. Next, we have no idea.
That was Tunis University Professor Hamadi Radis, who says passage of the country's new constitution threatens its fledgling democracy. Details coming up. Also, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov will round off his Africa tour by meeting with Ethiopian officials in Addis Ababa. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. On his first trip to Cameroon, French President Emmanuel Macron met today with long-ruling President Paul Biya to discuss security, economic, and food challenges. Like much of Africa, Cameroon is struggling with rising prices for fuel and grain, caused in part by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Mokidwen Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
French President Emmanuel Macron says Russia's targeting of Ukrainian exports is responsible for global food and fuel shortages that are causing untold suffering across Africa. Speaking Tuesday in Yaoundé after meeting with Cameroon's President Paul Biya, Macron said he is particularly worried that the consequences of the war will be increasingly felt in Africa, where many people go without sufficient fuel and food, and shortages have led to unprecedented price increases.
C'est pour faire face à ces conséquences.
Macron says France will help African countries face the shock caused by the war by encouraging local investments in agriculture to increase food production. Macron says he totally agrees with European Union leaders' call on Russia to immediately stop targeting Ukrainian agricultural facilities and to permit the export of Ukrainian grain. Macron said European economic sanctions on Russia, which are having an indirect effect on Africa, are intended to stop Russia's attack on Ukraine's sovereignty and not to punish Africans. He said France is interested in the well-being of civilians in both African countries and Ukraine. The visiting French president did not say how much France would invest to boost agricultural production in Africa, but said Cameroon is one of the countries chosen for agricultural investment. The UN says that Africa depends on Russia and Ukraine for more than 50% of its wheat imports. Macron said France will give support to countries fighting terrorism should the affected countries request France's military assistance. He said his country is still considering if French troops can be deployed to Africa, as was the case in some countries, including Mali. Cameroon faces Boko Haram terrorism that has killed over 30,000 people and displaced 2 million within 10 years in its northern border with Chad and Nigeria. The Central African state also faces separatist conflicts that have killed at least 3,300 people and displaced more than 750,000 in 5 years, according to the UN. Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, said he is very happy that France has pledged to help with what he called Africa's predicaments. He said living conditions will improve in Africa when terrorism is eliminated or reduced, and if Western countries negotiate an end to Russia's war in Ukraine. Biya says he is very happy that France has agreed to assist not only Cameroon, but the entire African continent to fight against security threats. He says support from France will enable Cameroon to totally destroy Boko Haram. Biya says he suggested to Macron that Russia's war in Ukraine, which is causing untold suffering across Africa, should be ended by way of dialogue between Western powers and Russia, not through confrontation or war. France says Macron, accompanied by the French ministers of foreign affairs, armed forces and foreign relations, and the French Secretary of State for Development will leave Cameroon Tuesday night for Benin and later Guinea-Bissau. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The World Health Organization is urging people who may have been exposed to or may be at risk of monkeypox to get vaccinated against the disease as a preventative measure. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Since it declared monkeypox a global health threat last week, the World Health Organization says the disease has continued to spread around the world, with cases topping 16,000 in at least 75 countries. The WHO says the outbreak is mainly concentrated among men who have sex with men, especially those with multiple sexual partners. It warns against stigmatizing a whole group of people, as this could cause the outbreak to accelerate exponentially by driving the disease underground. The WHO technical leader on monkeypox, Rosamund Lewis, says the outbreak can be stopped with the right strategies in the right groups. She says mass vaccination is not required, but the WHO recommends vaccination for those who have been exposed or are at risk.
When someone is vaccinated, it takes several weeks for the immune response to be generated by the body. And so it's not something you can be vaccinated one day and be protected the next. You need to give it some time. So the folks we're recommending to be vaccinated right now are anyone who has exposure, a contact with someone who may have then been confirmed to have monkeypox. And so that could be family members. It could be other close contacts.
She says even children are not immune from getting the disease. She says between 80 and 90 cases of monkeypox in children have been reported in several countries, mostly in households where someone was infected. The monkeypox virus is spread from person to person through close bodily contact. It can cause a range of symptoms, including painful sores. Those at highest risk for the disease or complications include women who are pregnant, children, and people who are immunocompromised. European countries have the highest number of confirmed cases. Although monkeypox is endemic in Africa, where it has been present since 1970, the reported caseload is relatively low. For example, Nigeria reports 101 cases, and the Democratic Republic of Congo has confirmed 163 cases out of more than 2,000 suspected cases. Lewis says the number of suspected cases in the DRC is high because the country's ability to confirm cases through laboratory testing is limited. She says testing needs to be supported and ramped up.
Suspected cases may be other things. They may be even measles, they may be chickenpox. There's no vaccine for chickenpox being used in that environment. So it is critically important to support countries to access testing. That's one of the most important things that WHO is trying to do right now. But at the same time, in the global reports, what we're reporting are confirmed and probable cases.
For now, no travel-related monkeypox restrictions are in place. However, the WHO recommends anyone with signs or symptoms compatible with the monkeypox virus should avoid travel and isolate for the duration of the illness. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will round off his Africa tour by meeting with Ethiopian officials in Addis Ababa as he fends off accusations that his country is exporting hunger through its war in Ukraine. I talked to Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, about Lavrov's visit and Russia's objective in Africa.
Well, a big part of Lavrov's visit is to recast Russia's invasion of Ukraine as a broader east-west struggle. And to the extent that he is able to do that, then, you know, few African countries are going to be critical. I think the visit more broadly is also an attempt for Russia to demonstrate that it is not a pariah, that it remains an active, you know, great power that can move around the world and be welcomed, and therefore demonstrate, at least symbolically, that it is not isolated.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, by meeting with Ethiopian officials in Addis Ababa, trying to fend off accusations that his country is exporting hunger through its war in Ukraine. And that's the kind of message he gave in the DRC as well as in Uganda. Can he really sell that?
Well, he's trying very hard to do that. It is a tough sell. You know, it is Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the blocking of the port of Odessa that has blockaded some, you know, 20 million metric tons of Ukrainian grain from reaching the international markets. This has had a very sharp impact on, you know, global grain prices, and including in Africa, where grain prices have on average, you know, doubled this year. And, you know, that's largely because of the Russian invasion in Ukraine. And there are a number of African countries that have been particularly hard hit, including in Ethiopia. And so I think Russia's going to try very hard to portray, you know, the food crisis as a result of Western sanctions. But in fact, you know, the Western sanctions don't affect food, including Russian grain. So should Russia want to export its own grain, that is not impacted. And, you know, it's I think, highly revealing that even with this recent deal between Ukraine and Russia that was to free up Ukrainian grain so that it could get out into international markets, you know, the very next day after the deal, you know, Russia bombed the port of Odessa. And so it seems very clear that Russia is going to continue to weaponize the food crisis as a way to try and blame the West for the suffering that is being felt all over the world because of this, you know, sharp impact on the supply chain of grains.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with me from Washington. In Ethiopia, Lavrov is visiting a country that has also been under Western pressure over its war with Tigray rebels, and it has a historic friendship with Russia. Fred Harter reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will round off his Africa tour by meeting Ethiopian officials in Addis Ababa as he fends off accusations that his country is exporting hunger through its war in Ukraine. He will also try and strengthen ties with Ethiopia's federal government, whose relationships with the West has soured amid accusations of human rights abuses in the Tigray conflicts. Russia's presence in Ethiopia is scant compared to other countries. It does not have a large aid footprint like the US, nor does it invest heavily in infrastructure as the Chinese do. But the two countries have a strong diplomatic partnership. Since the Tigray war started in November 2020, Russia has shielded Ethiopia at the United Nations Security Council by insisting meetings be held behind closed doors and using its veto to block statements condemning alleged abuses by Ethiopian forces. It is not unusual to hear people in Addis Ababa express a preference for Russia over Western countries, which Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government has suggested are behind a conspiracy supporting the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. Morgis Sodu Tashomi, an independent researcher, says the Russia-Ethiopia relationship has deep historical roots.
The Ethiopian government has always been in a good relationship, even during those turbulent periods of the Cold War. Of course, siding with the Soviet Union, as you may recall. And then, if we see it in the context of the current quagmire which Ethiopia is in, when it comes to its international relations and the foreign policy posture, Russia has been backing the Ethiopian claims and or at least positions in the UN Security Council.
Ethiopian officials will likely seek assurances from Lavrov that Black Sea wheat exports will resume. Ethiopia has plans to boost its wheat production in an attempt to become self-sufficient. But for the time being, it imports over 40% of its grain from Ukraine and Russia, and some 30 million Ethiopians currently rely on food aid, much of which is sourced from global grain markets. Last year, as the Tigray war continued, Russia signed a security partnership with Ethiopia. The deal raised eyebrows among Western diplomats whose country suspended aid. However, Awet Weldy Michael, a professor at Queen's University in Ontario, says Russia cannot displace the presence of the West in Ethiopia, especially as the Prime Minister tries to rehabilitate ties with the US, now the conflict in Tigray is cooling down.
I don't think that the West's relationship with the Ethiopian Prime Minister is as bad as it was 6 months ago or a year ago. We increasingly see the West has been actively normalizing Prime Minister and his policies. In light of that, in light of the mending offenses, so to speak, between Addis Ababa and Western capitals, I doubt that Foreign Minister Lavrov will have much of a chance.
Ethiopia abstained from voting on the UN resolution condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine in March. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
General Mohamed Hamdan Hamditi, deputy head of Sudan's ruling Sovereign Council, says the military decided to hand over the country's governance to civilians and focus on defense and security. He urged political forces to promptly start forming transitional institutions through dialogue, followed by free and fair elections. A spokesperson for Forces of Freedom and Change, a key civilian group, considered that statement as more proof that the military is serious, while a spokesperson for the Sudanese Professional Association said it offers nothing new since the generals control all major keys in Sudan. Cameron Hudson, a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Well, the statement was originally made by the head of the army, General Burhan, about 2 weeks ago now. And so the fact that General Hameti is essentially saying the same thing that was already said, I think is an effort for him to remain relevant and to demonstrate that even if the military decrees something, it remains in question unless the RSF, the force that he controls, goes along with it. And so this was him signaling that not only does he support the position of the military, but I think trying to demonstrate that he is a power and a force unto himself who also has to sign off on these kinds of government decrees unless we think that they won't go forward.
A spokesperson for Forces of Freedom and Change considered that statement as another proof that the military is serious, while a spokesperson for the Sudanese Professional Association said that Hameti's statement offers nothing new since the generals control all major keys in Sudan. Could that lead to more division and a continued stalemate in the Sudanese political crisis?
Well, I think what the statement by General Hameti is doing is trying to put pressure on Sudanese political actors to continue the political crisis. Very clearly, there has been not a lot of forward momentum in the political talks, but by stepping away from the political talks, the military is removing itself from the blame game that is going on in Khartoum, putting all responsibility on civilians to determine the future course of the political makeup, while at the same time, the military is consolidating the control over the elements of the politics and society of the country and the economics of the country that it has a direct interest and stake in. So the military is, I think, being rather cute in trying to create political problems for pro-democracy groups while at the same time basically just ensuring that its own political and economic interests are guaranteed.
Hameti pointed out that the latest wave of tribal conflicts in Sudan is an imminent threat to Sudan's unity, adding that the country is going through the most dangerous crisis in its modern history. Did that crisis genuinely motivate the military to respond to public pressure to restore democracy in Sudan?
Let's remember that the cause of the crisis in Sudan is the military. It is the role of the RSF and the military. They have created this crisis. And so here you have General Hameti serving essentially as arsonist and firefighter. He creates the problems and then presents himself as a solution to those problems. And so, again, I just think that this is a very disingenuous way that the military has over many decades now created the problem of insecurity in the country and then presented itself as the only only solution to solving that insecurity, when in fact it is just merely an effort to undermine civilian rule in the country.
The military coup not only created a political crisis, but also led to a severe economic crisis in Sudan. What's the way out of both the political and the economic crisis in Sudan?
Well, it's very simple. The military needs to give up power. It needs to give up its control over 80% of the economy. You have a military state in Sudan, and so there can be no political outcome or economic outcome that benefits the majority of the Sudanese people as long as the vast majority of power and wealth in the country is concentrated in the hands of a very small few in the military.
That was Cameron Hudson, a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Nigeria's government has ordered federal government colleges in Abuja to close following security threats by bandits who have been kidnapping residents of nearby communities. We have more details from Abuja.
Nigeria's Minister of Education, Adamu Adamu, who issued the directive yesterday, said it was the result of rising insecurity and threats to the lives and well-being of the students. It has halted the ongoing third term examination and the senior school certificate examination going on in the schools. A defense and security consultant, Group Captain Sadiq Garuba Shehu, retired, spoke to VOA on the implications of the closure.
If schools are disrupted like this, certainly the education of the children, which is the future of the country, is going to be severely affected, and that is going to affect national development and the manpower development. Parents certainly are going to lose by having their children's education being disrupted and also monitoring.
Shehu said the recent attack on the Kuje Correctional Center, which freed Boko Haram fighters and other inmates, has made Abuja unsafe and significantly increased fear among the public and the government.
Common sense dictates that the capital city of a country should be the one that is most secure. So if these people can come and attack somewhere in Kuje and carry out an operation, unfortunately it sends a negative signal to residents, to many people that have businesses or intend to do business in Nigeria.
One of the schools, Federal Government College, Kwali, had asked parents on Monday to evacuate their wards after a community adjoining its fence was attacked by bandits who kidnapped some of the residents. The situation reflects serious concerns about the insecurity situation in Nigeria and raises questions about how to end attacks by bandits that have hit several parts of the country. A security strategist, David Okoro, pointed out ways the government can end this dilemma.
I've always said that we need political will and political action by the political leadership from the position of Mr. President down to the governors, because clearly that political will doesn't seem to be there. You can see it every time. There are things that are supposed to be done at the highest level by political leadership, and those actions are not being taken. Or even when those actions are ordered, they are never implemented.
Okoro also spoke to VOA on yesterday's attack and abduction of a community head and family in Kuje, Abuja. He urged the government to re-engage those who have retired in the security sectors to help deal with insecurity issues, which are a major issue ahead of next year's presidential election. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.